Here's another thing, but this one, the Tawdry Yard program, is a little bit different. It's a beacon. So this is where, probably, then they kill you with a drone. That's pretty scary stuff. They also have this for microphones to gather room bugs, for room audio. Notice the bottom, it says, all components are common off the shelf and are so non-attributable to the NSA, unless you have this photograph and the product sheet. So, who was not surprised by this? I'm so glad to have finally reached a point where no one raised their hand except that one guy who I think misheard me. And if you work for the NSA, I'd just like to encourage you to leak more documents.
Independent journalist Jacob Applebaum speaking at the just concluded Chaos Communications Conference. And that concludes the second part of our Earthwatch exploration of NSA espionage and potential privacy countermeasures. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we welcome your comments, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
And you are tuned. Robert, you ended 40 seconds early. How unusual. You're usually, like, dead on time. But that program was brought to you with portions on recording. This is WBAI in New York City. Pardon me while I try to find theme music or something like that. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And Hour of the Wolf is coming up. Oh, gee. Momentarily, if I can... Oh, I think I can find the theme. Nope, that's not it. We could all, like, you know, sing together or howl or something like that. Because, my drive isn't working. And I'm not talking about, you know.
Your personal drive.
I'm not talking about, yeah, I'm not talking about my personal drive. I'm talking about...
Which is still working superbly, I'm sure.
Oh, if only, if only. But I beg everybody's pardon. Because even if I... I see. It says it's there. Pardon me. Pardon me. It's our, you know, dealing. I like analog equipment, okay? I am not as fond. Ah, there it goes, of all this digital stuff that sometimes works because it's, after all, residing on WBAI equipment and sometimes not. But it has finally decided to go in. So you know what? Yeah, might as well try to play the intro. Stay tuned.
Hour of the Wolf movie review.
Ah, jeez. You know, you're supposed to be queuing up stuff, not playing it the moment it's there. Let's, you know, that, okay, that didn't happen, everybody, okay? Set your watch back. Set your watch back for about, oh, you know, a minute and a half or so, and then pretend the wolf is howling again.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Richard Bowes. We will be talking with After, a movie review from Dan Persons. Stay tuned. Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date January 9th, 2014, 47 Ronin. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. And this is another situation where I want to tread carefully. It's not that 47 Ronin is a great film. It's just that I think it didn't really get a fair shake at the box office. I guess it could be said that Universal knew what it was doing when it dumped the film into theaters on December 25th, Christmas Day, the day usually saved for Oscar contenders and or critics' darlings with little commercial appeal, and films that studios know aren't going to get traction with the paying public, whether because of lack of quality or because the marketing department just has no idea how to sell them. And watching 47 Ronin, I did say to myself, this film is going to do gangbusters everywhere, except the United States. Jury's still out as far as the rest of the world is concerned, but I was right about the U.S. The film came in ninth on its opening weekend, and that was with a two-day head start. That's not good. So what did people miss? Not Keanu Reeves' greatest performance. He does essentially what he usually does in a genre action film, kind of a stoic dudeness. But that's good enough. He's not hurting anything. And not a model of seamless storytelling. There does come a point in the narrative when it feels like the filmmakers are going, well, we gotta kill a little time here. And you do have to contend with Reeves inexplicably being the sole Westerner in a Japanese legend. But honestly, director Carl Rynch integrates him far better than I was anticipating. And that's what makes this film interesting, the fact that Rynch takes one of the signature legends of Japanese history, a group of disgraced samurai called Ronin, seek revenge against a corrupt lord after he forces their master to commit ritual seppuku, brings it into the fantasy realm with witches, dragons, and mystical warriors, drops Reeves in as a sort of adoptive servant of the disgraced lord without much more explanation than that he may be either possessed by demons or a demon himself, and makes it work. Part of the reason for that is that while this film takes historical events into the fantasy realm, this tale was told as straight drama many times before on film, most famously by Kenji Mizoguchi in 1941. Here, Rynch remains faithful to the essential nature of the story and what it says about the Japanese character
and the Japanese sense of honor, all the way to not betraying the tale's rather downbeat ending. It helps that a Japanese production company co-produced this. This actually feels like Japan by way of Hong Kong. There is that distinct feel of the kind of crowd-pleasing historical fantasy the Chinese do, including effects that run the gamut of believability, but are always at the very least amusing. That Japanese involvement also maybe explains why, while Reeves is clearly meant to be the box office draw here, which it turns out didn't particularly help, he doesn't unduly monopolize the proceedings, with as much weight being given to the Japanese cast, most prominently Hiroyuki Sanada as the leader of the renegade samurai, and Rinko Kikuchi, previously seen here in Pacific Rim, as a power-hungry witch. Look, 47 Ronin isn't a cinema classic, although I was pleased enough with it to put it on my 10 best list for 2013, albeit at the bottom. But it is supremely entertaining, with no little appreciation for the significance of the legend it's appropriating. And that made it worthwhile for me, and makes it worth checking out if you're up for some cool Asian action fantasy. You're probably going to have to wait for it to come to video now, but it'll be worth the wait. I'm Dan Persons. If you love fantastic film, please check out Cinefantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. And I have to admit, Rick and I were talking. I did not get a chance to hear the interview, the review. I will hear it when we get home. Dan was on the program last week along with Terrence Taylor, and we had a fascinating discussion, I thought. It was fascinating, about the movie Her. And it's very... What's that face, Rick? Have you seen it? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, let's start.
Well, nothing happens. it's... You know, if I was still in the fashion business, I would say the point is to be made there. You could do a whole bunch of stuff. She could wear more different clothes than she does. You know, you could...
Scarlett, you mean, or yeah. Amy Adams? I mean, there's also Olivia Wilde and Rooney Mara.
Yeah, that's right.
Terry was his pre-LA name. Terrence and Barbara and I all thought it was superb.
Oh, well.
Best science fiction film of the year if you don't count Gravity.
Well, that's true. I suspect Gravity is going to walk off with the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and then you can have a pedantic argument over is or isn't Gravity science fiction. For purposes.
Well, Gravity is science fiction, yeah, because it's writing, it's depicting something that didn't happen and a technology that, while technically it all does exist, is used in a way that it has never and I don't think really possibly could be used. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many lucky breaks have to take place that if it isn't science fiction, it's fantasy.
Well, let's put it this way. I agree that it's science fiction on the grounds that it took 7 years to make. And when Alfonso Cuarón, was writing the film, the technology did not all exist.
Well, it's beyond,
so it was written as science fiction.
Right, it was written as science fiction, but also one of the hallmarks for me of science fiction is the incredible luck of the narrator, the incredible luck of the hero. I alone am surviving, I'm living to tell you this kind of thing. And that was on full force in Gravity.
There were a number of movies like that last year, weren't there?
Well, there always are. I mean, that's part of what a movie does.
Yeah, but they were very high-profile films, though, between Life of Pi and...
Life of Pi, I think, was the year before.
Technically,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the Robert Redford film, which has an ambiguous ending. I'm forgetting the name of it. Well, it's one guy in a boat. And
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
A hallmark of speculative fiction is the amazingly lucky I mean, science fiction on some level is just adventure fiction.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the backbone of Gravity. I mean, it was a compelling film. I mean, you could not watch it. I think if she had had more wardrobe changes, it would have had some of the same effect as her.
We're talking about Sandra Bullock, you know,
yes,
wardrobe
yeah.
changes.
Yeah, I think if she had, you know...
yeah, okay, yeah. Fine, yeah.
Then it could have been, you know, you could speak of them in the same breath, pretty much.
Yeah, maybe. Pardon me, I loved her. I thought it was intelligent. Pardon me, a well-written spec fic.
Yep. No, and short.
Yeah.
Which I like in a movie.
Yes, so do I. It did not outlive its welcome.
Yes. Well, there is a thing that I sit in these movies and I say, it must have been necessary that the movie be 2 hours and 45 minutes long, because there is nothing to explain the fact that it didn't end after an hour and 50 minutes, except for the fact that it had to be this long. There's no other explanation for this.
Yeah, now explain The Hobbit. You can't.
I can't explain it. I didn't see it. I have no intention of seeing it. I'm going to say an awful thing.
I will say two words. Wise choice.
I would say three words. Tolkien is boring.
Yes. But you see, but it wasn't Tolkien.
Right.
The film is not Tolkien.
Well, you can find a slip out of that. But anyway, yes.
Anyhow, my guest this morning is Rick Bowes, who on Dust Jackets is known as Richard Bowes. Dust Jackets and Bylines. And for those who have not been regular listeners to the show, I have no idea how many times you've been on this program now.
An awful lot of times.
Yeah. I mean, since we've moved to this facility, and that's under a year ago, I think this is your third time here.
I think at least, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was in the prior location not long before you had to abandon that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there any number of times.
That's right.
I was there when the
show... Well, we were there for 12 years.
I was there. Well, I was on the show when, you know, the show would end and you could go out into the next room and watch the sun come up over the Hudson River.
Oh, you mean during the Hour of the Wolf.
The Hour of the Wolf, yeah.
Yes, how about that?
Yep.
Yeah, no, the view, in fact, when Ellen Kushner was on the show and I was telling her, well, you know, this is it, we're going to be leaving here, she said, you're going to be losing the view.
An amazing visual.
Yeah.
Especially at that moment. It would be Saturday morning when New York would be relatively calm, very early Saturday morning. And the light from... Over the Hudson Bay, just
seeing,
spectacular.
Governor, you know, looking past Governor's Island,
absolutely,
and, yeah, gorgeous view. We don't have that here,
really.
Yeah,
no.
we're in
the cellar.
We're in the bowels of what used to be Lewisohn Stadium.
That's right.
I had not realized that.
That's right. Yeah.
It was Gordon Lindsner. Of course, you
know, Who would know these things,
one look at the location and said, oh, it's Lewisohn Stadium. And it's like, oh, my God, yes.
I remember being in Upper Manhattan and the person I was with saying, it's the Polo Grounds. And that was where we were. I mean,
uh-huh.
it's the housing development at this point.
Not terribly far from where we are right now.
No,
right?
Not too far.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
But, yes.
Yeah, we're on Sugar Hill in Harlem.
That's right. A nice neighborhood.
It is, actually.
Yeah,
it's a very nice neighborhood around here. I've only been here a couple of times during the day, but I've always been... It's a lovely neighborhood.
Yeah,
good people, too. So, who am you, anyway, for those who don't know? You have how many books in print at this moment?
Well, I don't know how many of them are in print. This last year, I brought out four books.
In 2013,
I brought out four books. And I've had 10 books altogether out. I'm not sure how... Well, everything is
available. We have to explain at least one of those books was a reprint.
One was a reprint, but the other three were original, at least in this manifestation. It was a couple of collections of short stories, including my favorite book by myself of all, The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others.
I am not surprised that it's your favorite of all.
Which is it's modern fairy tales, but it's all duded up with Rackham and Doré illustrations from classic fairy tale, right, classic 19th
the
century.
The Andrew Lang era.
Yes, yeah, and the pre-
The great fairy tales, and I have to say, Andrew Lang. And pre-Andrew Lang, yeah, the salons.
Saloons.
The saloons and the salons, yes. Both of them. I grew up with household tales, as you know, the German
right.
stuff.
Yep.
And that brought me eventually to Charles Perrault and the others. Never a fan of Hans Christian Andersen was I.
No,
and,
no.
I have to
say.
Too
weepy.
Yeah. And Christian. I mean, the morality.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, they really.
Yep.
You know, guess what, boys and girls? That movie, that's not what happens at the end of The Little Mermaid. And Frozen versus the Snow Queen, uh-uh. But the... what the stories that you wrote in there, I would say, remind me of another book or series of stories that I love by Theodora Goss.
Yes, that collection that she brought out.
That collection.
I think it's the only book she's brought out.
I think so.
Right.
Those two books are great companions to each other.
But I got better pictures.
Maybe. Now, who did the illos for your book?
The illustrations for the book were...
They're public domain.
Well, this is the thing about it. They're not. When you see something online, you know, you go to Google and you look for the images, a lot of those images, although Rackham, Rackham and Doré have both been dead for so long that they're... copyrights.
And they don't have families to
Well, no, it's 70 years from the death of the artist.
Well, yeah, unless it's Mickey Mouse or...
70 years from the death of the artist.
Right.
But the pictures themselves have had something done to them, and that has been copyrighted. But the editor of the book, and the poor woman, I'm not going to remember her name at this point, it was for Aqueduct, and...
A great press, Aqueduct.
Great press, and they did this really nice little book. She found illustrations online that were not available. Illustrations that were not in any way owned, uh-huh. And so those are in the book. But it was, you know, you can't just do that. Everything is a more complicated process. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. I love the result. But anyway, then there is another collection of short stories, If Angels Fight, which is longer stories and not fairy tale-ish, and contains a lot of the award-nominated and award-winning stories that I've had over the years. The other two books were a reprint of Minions of the Moon, which came out in 1999 and was a Lambda Award winner.
And the Lambda Award being?
The best gay, in my case, the best gay fantasy or science fiction, the best speculative fiction novel of the year. And
with a gay theme, yeah.
Right. Well, yes, it's the Lambda, it's pretty much the gay theme, but...
Well, maybe some listeners might not know. They just think, they admire Greek letters.
They
know?
Do. They like, they all fraternity boys. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. and actually, they may well be.
Right.
But,
many of them, more of them than one would think. But, yes... and then I also brought out Minions of the Moon is something that in the genre and elsewhere was called a fix-up. Minions of the Moon was 10 short stories that were taken and rearranged. No story is as it was when it was published. All of them have had things done to it, and it was turned into a novel.
But they all feature a common...
A common narrator, Kevin Grierson, who happens to be me. And it's a novel about... It's a man who has a doppelganger and has problems of addiction, drug and sexual addiction, which in the book are resolved. And the original novel that I did last year was Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, which in some ways is the same narrator. It's me.
And but it's a different you.
It's a different me. It's much more, I mean, Grierson undergoes the kind of trials and tribulations that would have killed an actual person. I mean, I don't think any kid would have survived what happened to Grierson as a kid, and then I don't think any adult would have been functional after that point. But Dust Devil, it's an older gay writer in Greenwich Village, and this is a subject with which I am
intimately
attuned. I would say I was attuned to this subject. And it's 12 stories.
And while 15. I admire Minions of the Moon, and I loved it as a book, and even the news story, Dust Devil is masterful.
Well, I'm glad that you liked it, and other people have. It's gotten some incredibly good reviews. Wish it had incredibly good sales, but it definitely has had incredibly good reviews. And I wrote the stories over a period of, well, the first one was There's a Hole in the City, and that was
which I hope the AI listeners are familiar with.
I hope everybody is familiar with that. But that came out in 2005. And
I'm damned proud of the audio.
That is a stupendous one. I'm proud of it also.
I'm glad you are. I'm really pleased.
Especially the one where you're not correcting me all the time.
Oh, that God. God. Oh, please. Oh, yeah, please. I played that this year.
You did indeed.
Oh, boy, God.
A lot of people were very...
And I still haven't fixed... You know what I need? I gave you... WBAI gave you, Matt, at 388 Atlantic Avenue at our home office, gave me for you 30 copies.
Yes, you would like one of those.
I would like one of those, yeah.
I will give you some of those.
Autographed. One. All I need is one. After that, I can reproduce it.
Okay, I will. If you remind me of this, I will give that.
I will try. I'm terrible at that, yeah.
But anyway, yes, this is like 15 stories, and it does have a theme. I mean, the theme is aging gracefully in a... Greenwich Village is a place where you can age gracefully.
Yeah.
Basically, it's an old people's home at this point.
There's more to it than that. I mean, you know, talking about the kind of relationships, the kind of joy that I got out of the movie Her, I would say I get a similar joy from your characters, from the quiet, speculative nature, which is on the one hand sort of earth-shattering and at the same time every day. I hope I'm making some kind of
the wonder
sense.
Of the,
I'm really
the wonder
taking
of the
risk
mundane.
To the writer.
It's the wonder of the mundane. There are things in that just happened. I mean, there's a scene in the book which actually took place. It was just after I retired, and I...
You were a librarian.
I was a reference assistant.
Okay.
I don't have a librarian's degree. Don't have any.
You worked in a library.
I worked
at a
in a library.
University.
I answered questions at a desk in a library. But I was had just recently retired, and I was enjoying the living hell out of that. And I came out the door. I had to go to a memorial service, which, you know, you get older in life, a lot of your entertainment comes from, you know, memorial services, funerals, stuff like that. I was going to a memorial service, came down steps, and this was 2006. And everything on the street had been changed back into 1960. All of the signs for the old cafes were up. All of the little stores that had existed then were there. And I thought, well, this is it. You know, I'm either dead or they're going to...
Or this flu medication is really great.
It really is much better than I had ever imagined.
Yeah, yeah.
But it turned out to be a movie. It was a scene from Factory Girl, I think, which, in fact, in the movie was like 30 seconds. But... Yeah, so that in a way, the
Factory
wonderment.
Factory Girl? Is that a pre-code?
No, it's, I'm not going to remember the woman's name. I'm not going to remember anything. She was that woman who was taken up by the Warhol studio. Edie Sedgwick.
Oh!
Sedgwick story. And it contains...
Sorry, yes.
It contains an I have seen, like, five Andy Warhols on film. And the one in Factory Girl, he's that Australian actor. He was in Pulp Fiction, in the lesser role in Pulp Fiction. He was the best Warhol on film. The most like the... I mean, David Bowie in Basquiat. If Warhol had actually been like that, his death would have been a national tragedy. I mean, the flags would have been at half-mast. But in fact, Bowie was infinitely more interesting than Warhol ever was. But the one in Factory Girl struck me as being very, very, very accurate. But anyway, that isn't important. The thing was that for a moment, there was wonder there on the street. And in that neighborhood, I think more than most, this does happen. You do get, my God, did I actually see this thing that I obviously actually saw?
Yeah.
We were talking about...
It's a great saying. Delaney uses it in Dahlgren, that there are parts in... He's more, a little more Soho than Village, but it's still the same, you know, they're half a mile apart. And he uses it in a similar manner.
Well, we were talking when we were driving here about the High Line, and I was saying that, again, that was surrealism back in the 60s, when early 70s, when that strip was along the waterfront, there was a strip indeed, that at night a freight train would come rumbling overhead and all of the incredible activity would cease.
Yeah.
Yes, all would cease. All of the guys in the trucks and out on the piers would stop for a moment what they were doing, and the train would go rumbling past. It was an amazing, but also sort of miraculous, and a blast from a past. I mean, that this was definitely a prior New York manifesting itself. So that's what Dust Devil is to some extent.
Yeah, the full title again for people.
Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, and it's by Richard Bowes. Available at any place that online that sells books, you can get Dust Devil.
But the best way to do it...
is Amazon.com.
No. No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No. The best way is at RickBowes.com.
No. No, you have to do it through Amazon. You can't get them through.
Okay, okay. Talk to Chris.
No.
When I set up your first website, damn it, for Time Rangers, when I set up your first website, I made it so that if people went to your website and bought the book, you got a kickback.
Right, and nobody ever did.
So true.
Yeah.
I was watching the numbers. I mean, not a few people, but, you know, hey, you got like $20 or something.
Yeah. Didn't get a cent. No, we were.
They
cheating.
Owe you. They owe you.
Well, they owe me for some. Any,
okay, fine. Amazon or
Amazon owes me.
Or
but anyways,
Powell.
Okay,
or
this is not. And
anyway, not
ordering
relevant.
It online is easy to do, and well, I'm hoping that, you know, it'll get some love at the awards. But
yeah, Hugo nominations, by the way, just speaking of which, just opened up.
Well, I don't think that will be on the agenda,
one
but
can try.
Yes, I think it's more a Jackson Award type novel.
Yes, okay. Yeah. As in Shirley.
As in Shirley, yes.
Okay,
yeah. Not Charles. No,
no, no. I was thinking Jackson Award. Oh, the Shirley Jackson
the
Award
Shirley
is
Jackson
given out every year at ReaderCon.
Indeed, it is.
Yes. Do you consider it horror?
No.
Isn't the Jackson Award is sort of
dark? It's certainly
dark fantasy.
Dark
yeah.
fantasy. It's certainly dark fantasy. Most of the stuff that gets nominated for the Jacksons isn't horror. I mean, some of it is, but a lot of it isn't. And yeah, this would pass as horror.
It could. Yeah.
I mean,
I always thought I don't like horror, and then having conversations largely on the air with Ellen Datlow and with Dan Persons, I'm saying, well, I don't like that, but I do like this, and I do like this. And they're saying, Jim, that's horror. You like horror. And one particular acquaintance of ours who happens to be in your writer's group, a woman named Barbara Krasnoff, thinks that she does not write horror. And then in 1 year got three honorable mentions for best horror short story.
Well, the difference between dark...
That came from Ellen Datlow.
Right.
And we're going, well, I guess you write horror.
Well, it's undefinable. It's undefinable. And the difference between dark fantasy and horror is impossible to define. A lot of Ellen's horror anthologies are actually full of dark fantasy. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
And when people say they don't like horror...
She doesn't bother defining it.
Right. When people say they don't like horror, they mean they don't like picking up the hitchhiker who turns into a be the wolf man or something
like
that.
Yeah, it's funny.
People who wake up and discover their kidneys have been stolen. That sort of thing people don't like.
I edited an audio reading of a horror story today that I was amazed how much I liked it. And it was, in its way, classic horror.
Well, you know, you get people like Laird Barron who...
He's good.
Right. It's writing horror, but...
Or there's a guy who's going to be reading it, the KGB Fantastic Fiction series, this coming Wednesday.
Joe Hill.
Joe... I dreamed I saw him last night.
as alive as you and me.
but I said, Joe, you're 10 years dead. That's what makes it horror, that he's 10 years dead.
You know, the first time I ever saw Joe Hill was at KGB, and he was this new writer who had a few stories out and had just brought out a collection. And
he had not yet come out
of the closet. And yeah. I had never seen a new writer with as much presence and self-confidence as he had. And I was walking home with Ellen afterwards, and I mentioned this, I've never seen anyone this, and she said, don't tell anyone, but it's Stephen King's son.
And you've got to give him so much cred for not banking on that.
Well, he's a very nice man.
Joe Hill and Ennis Drake, whose work right. I am not familiar with.
Nor am I.
But that will be this coming Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the KGB Bar, free admission. But you should buy a drink.
And if you intend to go there, you should show up very early.
Very early. Doors open about 6:30. Be there at 5.
Right, Hospice Square.
85 East 4th Street, just off of 2nd Avenue.
You can't miss it.
Yeah, but there.
The left-wing Ukrainian clubhouse.
Yeah, it's, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the evil twin, no. There are two ongoing reading series in New York. One is them, one is mine. They're both great, damn it. Or the slogan that I've been trying to get Matt and Ellen to adopt, a great reading every fortnight.
Well, it's better that you're rivals, I think.
Oh!
No. Rivalry is better for quality. As long as there's an enemy out there somewhere, you have to be more.
The enemy is the mainstream. The enemy.
What
is the
I want to do. What I want to do is
the enemy are the people not coming, but we're both filling up usually,
right?
Except for last night's Tundra or whatever they called.
Oh, the polar eclipse of the
sidewalk that we had.
No, it was,
we had 30 people.
Well, that
for Sam Miller and 30
presences. Some of them.
There were 30 presences room, and given the weather,
it was warm. It was warm in there. That's what attracted them.
It certainly
them.
Was. No, but no, that was a nice turnout.
It was a nice turnout.
And we
it
had
also was a good reading.
And the reading before that, the event before that, we turned away about 40 or 50 people.
Should have let them come in and sit on the floor.
Yeah. But there's only so much that one can do. I mean, that was really, we were already, should I say this on the air, breaking fire laws. And then the reading before that was Raj Khanna and Fran Wild from Philadelphia, and we filled the place there with 60 people or so. KGB averages 60 to 80 people, I would say. We average 40 to 60 people. We're each filling up.
One of the odd things in writing, as the printed word kind of passes away, the desire for authors reading their own material has zoomed. I mean, I'm not particularly good at giving readings, and I don't particularly like doing it. But when I began in this, if you were asked once a year at a convention to do a reading, it was a big event. At this point, one is asked all the time. There were readings.
At this point, many conventions have at least one, if not two, rooms of
devoted to nothing but readings.
That's right.
And that certainly wasn't true 30 years ago when I started going to the convention. There would be readings, but not in that.
It would be the guest of honor.
But I mean, the number of readings, I mean, I'm going to next month, I will be reading for the Electric Velociped Memorial
Service.
Yeah,
you're probably going to have to come back here because Sam has informed me that he's going to be doing, Sam Miller has informed me that he's going to be doing an episode of Hour of the Wolf to promote that. And I said, fine, as long as we can get John Klima, who's the editor of Electric Velociped, on Skype.
We'll see.
I'm pointing out the computer. There's no reason he can't be on the show.
See what happens.
He's been here before.
Let's see what happens.
Well, I recorded it. Actually, we recorded a show at Yonah Schimmel's.
Right.
Really? It's great.
But, yes.
Like the old radio shows, Breakfast with Les and Beth.
Les and Beth. Well, Dorothy Kilgallen and her husband had a breakfast
that's
show.
That's right. But we had Knishes.
Right. yeah, he may do that. I think he's... Well, actually, let's talk about Electric Velocity.
We should mention that this is a memorial.
Let me read something from my book about Electric Velocity.
Please.
Or about the zines. And then we'll talk a little about
Electric. Let me just know, about how long will this reading?
It's a page. It'll take a few minutes.
Okay.
You might think in a genre devoted to the unknown and the unimaginable, surrealism and literary experimentation would be common modes. Not so. For a brief time, what's been called the new wave of the 1960s, early 70s, spec fiction found a place, even a prominent place, for experiment and the inexplicably strange. The new wave passed fairly quickly. Old ways and formats reasserted themselves. Things never returned to the stories for 11-year-old boys of all ages that had dominated the pulp magazines of the 40s and 50s. But there was no ready market for artistic innovation. And so it remained until the rise of the zines in the late 1990s. Kelly Link, Gavin Grant's Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet was the first. The offbeat was the staple fare, and the table of contents was impressive. For a while after that, it seemed as if every young writer also edited and published, often irregularly, a small quirky magazine devoted to the odd angles of storytelling. Like butterflies, these zines appeared, wonderful in their color and variety. Then mostly they were gone. Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet survives, and I was happy to discover recently that so does my own personal favorite, John Klima's Electric Philosophy. This was written before the sad impending demise. It was John and E.V. who published two stories by Mark Rich and me, including Jacket Jackson. And
yeah, now that was before. Now then, as I think shortly after that, or about that time, that John sold the distribution or the ownership. I think he sold the ownership of Electric Velocipede to a larger distributor. But he remained editor and in control of it. That was just about the time that he and I did the interview, and that was when Marley Humans was at KGB.
It was a magazine. I mean, it's gone through various troubles. But it was, there must have been at least a dozen, and there probably were more, of the zines at one time. His certainly was the most professionally produced. It had the best masthead. I mean, it had the best table of contents, in many, except possibly for Lady Churchill's. And it, sometimes intermittently, but it survived until it went out.
And there are book series that rival as well, but they're really not magazines like Clockwork Phoenix.
Clockwork Phoenix is a series of anthologies. It's not a zine. Yeah. Zine was a different thing. These were printed. Eventually, they became online. Originally, they were printed, and they were, you know, small. They were obscure. But they were, at one point in the genre, enormously influential with young writers. And also, they gave a place to experimental writing, which, as I say, oddly enough, is less common in speculative fiction than it is in mainstream fiction.
That there's been a melding, a crossover that...
No, I think that speculative fiction at its origins was a nuts and bolts fiction. You put the story together, you nail in a couple of rocket ships, you put this jet propulsion at the end of it, and you launch the thing. And John Campbell smiles upon you kind of attitude. There was no art.
And I love to point out to people who think that the term speculative fiction or spec fic is something that came around in the 90s or something like that for Lady Churchill. No, is in Astounding. It was coined by Robert A. Heinlein under the
It was coined many years ago, but it never was used to define a genre until maybe 20 years ago.
Despite Heinlein's attempt.
Well, Heinlein, look.
He tried to coin it. He tried to coin
it. Any of these people were writing, I mean, when he was trying to coin the thing, when you were doing the little review or the little essay in Analog, or nobody was reading those. Until everything went online and until online discussions were possible, anything that you tried to do to define the genre, which all of these people did, Asimov did it, Heinlein did it, they all had it, dabbled in this. It was very hard to launch these things. Nobody paid any attention. I mean, they talk about, you know, Campbell's editorials. Well, how many people actually read Campbell's editorials? I mean, I began reading speculative fiction, reading the magazines. When I was about 11 years old, there was I lived in Dorchester in Boston, in around Codman Square, and there were numbers places around. One of them had a vast quantity of magazines with the front covers torn off, which you could buy for 5 cents a piece, or because they like to have kids something using the store, because downstairs were guys placing numbers on horse races. And that's where I began reading this stuff. And I assure you, I never read an editorial. It was only the stories.
Now, I always did. I always read the columns. I read Willie Ley. I read...
Well, that was different. It was science.
I read the introductions. I read what Gordon Van Gelder has to say in FNSF. I used to read Gardner's pieces, and I always read Asimov. Read Asimov in FNSF.
No, you're talking about a later time.
Maybe so. I'm talking about the digest era. You're talking pulp.
Right. Well, the pulp were digests.
But it was the pulp era, and out of those things that Dianetics was born, God help us all.
Yes, it was a horrible time. Now there are many, many sad and frightening things. But the idea of literature or literary forms was simply not in the mix. And that is one of the things that the zines did, and I'd be very sorry. I'm very sorry to see E.V. go.
Yeah, Yeah, so there will be a memorial to Electric Velocipede held at Blue Stockings Books, and I think it's the end of February.
Last day of February.
Last day of February, 28th. Yeah.
Friday.
Yeah, there's no 29th this year, so it's 28th.
Friday the 28th. At Blue Stockings, and it'll be crowded.
It'll be crowded, and
as everything
to make sure
at Blue
it'll
Stockings
be crowded.
Always is.
But nevertheless, Sam Miller, who is helping to put it together, is beating the drum and has informed me that we will be doing a show. Although, you know, I'm not sure if we should do a show before the event because it is going to be filled, or if we should, you know, record it and have some of the people and talk about it after the event and do a special show that, you know, be a part of the tribute to the magazine. I should talk to Sam about that.
Yep.
Because I think we can go either way. Because there aren't a lot. There, it's not a lot of room for people at Blue Stockings to begin with. They can comfortably seat like 30,
but they can uncomfortably seat a great deal more.
Really?
Yeah, and I think if then
maybe 40.
Yeah, they can. You know, if
they're
you don't such
get a
sissies,
lot.
If
and,
they're such sissies, they
and
won't.
And you don't want to record there because you're recording somebody doing a lovely reading, and it's really good, and all of a sudden somebody orders a latte, and in the middle of the reading, I'm just going, oh, no, there goes. I'm not broadcasting that.
Why not? It was a beautiful latte.
It's Latte Night Radio, yes.
It's Latte
Night
Radio.
Here in WBAI New York.
No, everyone forgets, you know, this inside Llewellyn Davis thing does capture a lot of the way that the village folk scene looked. I mean, the darkness inside the places.
I have to ask you about that. I don't know if you were seeing, it was your birthday yesterday, so you didn't see a small online discussion debate about Llewellyn Davis.
There have been so many of them.
Well, this one was started by Christine Lavin in an article in the New York Times that I posted. And Ken Ficarra, who is a fine musician and friend of many good science fiction people, took exception.
Yes.
And I took exception to the exception. And somebody was saying, well, Jim, you weren't in the club scene. And actually, I was too young, but I was there in 1962, maybe.
Well,
I would have been at the Gaslight and said, how would you have gotten in there? My uncle took me.
No, there was no problem in getting into places.
No, and they were serving espresso. These aren't...
Right.
You know, these were not unfriendly places.
Oh, they were horrible. They were horrible places. But
I loved them.
Well, the visuals are captured. I mean, he is a completely unlikable person. And, you know, you really sort of...
And no, he is not modeled after Dave Van Ronk, as people say. Some of the events that happened to this person are similar to some of the events...
Right.
Of Van Ronk.
Right.
But
the idea,
he's
I had to live on the block they were filming the stuff on, and the rumor was rife that it was the Dave Van Ronk story. And I came out one day, and there was the guy who played Llewellyn Davis walking down the street with a guitar. Again, you know, it's like, oh my God, where am I? And all the cars were 1960 cars or 1950s cars.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing that I liked about it was, you know, usually if the thing is set in 1960, all the cars are 1960 cars. But in fact, in 1960, there were plenty of 1950s cars. There were even 1940s cars still around.
Of course.
And that they do have in the movie. But when I saw the guy walking down the street,
there are 20th century cars still on the road.
Right. When I saw the guy walking down the street, I said, whatever he is, he's not Dave Van Ronk. But,
it's not even one person. It's
however, there is a concert that T-Bone Walker, who oversaw the music for the movie, did a concert at Town Hall last September that completely captures the spirit of 1961.
Wow.
It's a beautiful thing. It's online. You can see it. It's the Llewellyn Davis themed concert or something. A lot of the music doesn't appear in Llewellyn Davis, but it is very...
There is an album, I believe.
It's coming out. Yeah. There's an album of the soundtrack for the movie, but there will be an album of that concert. And the album of that concert is something to get. It is terrific. It's a terrific thing.
I live for that stuff. I used to go down to Cooper Union for Oscar Brand's.
Yep.
Were they annual? How often did he? It seems to me like he did.
Constant.
constant flow. And yes, I would have been 9 or 10 years old when I started attending those. Why not?
Well, there were plenty of kids.
Despite the bawdy ballads.
Kids really don't grasp that, and if they're old enough to grasp that, they're no longer
kids. And they were clean enough for WNYC, which at that point was the municipally owned radio station of New York. And I loved those concerts.
No, there wasn't
great performers.
Some great performers. There were also some dreadful performers, but
But I had a good time. I was a kid.
That's right. Nothing else counts.
One
of the things that's odd is I go past these places like the Night Owl, which, you know, is a viable entertainment center, and I look at it now and I say, they couldn't have fit more than 15 people in there. I mean, these things were all so small.
The Gaslight was my favorite place.
Well, the Gaslight, you know, it
wasn't... That could seat about 40 people.
It wasn't lighted by gas, but light,
the
but
Village
it was...
Gaslight,
yeah, it wasn't far from it.
They had... the benches were about 4 inches wide,
right,
and you had a table that was thinner.
Well,
the American
behind was a lot smaller in those days than it is now.
But it was no less uncomfortable. Let me tell you.
Right, they looked like old church benches, but inside Llewellyn Davis. I'm sorry.
I have not yet seen that, I'm sorry to say. I'm such a big folky fan, and I'm a big...
You'll be fascinated.
I love the Coen Brothers movies. I'll get around to it.
Somebody said the Coen Brothers usually don't like their protagonists, and I think there is truth in that. I mean, they like the Big Lebowski for whatever reason. I don't know.
Not sure how much they do like him, the dude. They certainly don't like his friends.
No. And they liked when one of their wives played the cop in Fargo. I mean, she's a sympathetic character.
Yeah.
But on the whole, no.
Yes, Ethan Coen loves his wife. I mean, yeah.
That's right. Well, there have been headlines.
And Frances McDormand is just brilliant.
I saw her on stage in The Country Girl.
How was it?
She was terrific.
I think she's a terrific actress. But my favorite Frances McDormand movie is still, and now I always, Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day.
Right, yeah.
That's a wonderful
movie. It's a nice movie.
It really is. Her and Amy Adams and Lee Pace and Charon Hines, a wonderful cast. Movie did not get big distribution, didn't do a lot of business.
Well, it's not, that ain't the kind of movie that...
It's a wonderful little film.
There's a movie, and I think I'm getting the name. It's by Kenneth Frears, who did, you know, Prick Up Your Ear and... Stephen Frears. Philomena, which is an amazingly good movie.
I've not yet seen that.
An Irish, older Irish woman played by Dame... what's her name there? The one who's in the James Bond picture. She's in everything.
Judi Dench.
Yeah, right. James.
She was in the James Bond picture.
Right. She's
spoiler.
Spoiler. Right. She won't be anymore. But
They've gone retro. They've
gone so many things. But it's an Irish woman who had an illegitimate child who was taken away from her and adopted by Americans, and she seeks him out, and it's terrific. Her performance is astounding. I pity the actor who has to do a scene with her,
because
she's a scene stealer.
Maggie Smith.
I remember the thing with Maggie Smith. If it's that remake of the Peter Pan in which she's playing Wendy as an elderly woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a small child. Has a scene with a small child, and she takes the kid and presses his face against her bosom. So you don't see the kid's face.
Word. Yeah,
yeah, right. He can't see the kid's face. And I said, now there is an actress.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of the old school.
And
yeah.
I think the child was actually like her grandnephew or something. I mean, it was, uh-huh. But it didn't matter because the kid was not going to show their face on the screen while,
yeah.
While
despite us being a Spielberg movie, yeah.
Right? No, it was,
and Glenda Jackson would be doing the same, except she's stealing the scenes at Parliament. She's an MP.
Well, she
and
is.
And a great one. Mm. Oh, did you see? Go to YouTube, and when Thatcher died. And Parliament was trying to deify her, or
right now I have seen that
something. Oh my God! The speech she gave is one of the best performances since Elizabeth R. I mean,
no, she was astounding.
Yeah, yeah, it is. That was only a year ago. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. No, she. So. And she was. And I loved her in cinema too. You got something, you look like, you're looking at your books.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to. It's 2:30 already, and we have limited time. We could take calls, we could keep talking, or you could read. It's up to you.
Let me read just a little bit.
Okay, but I need, okay, hold on for a moment. I just need to do this here, so that, yeah. Now I'm set up for music. And there we are. Why is this not? Okay. I'm looking. I actually depend on getting my music from online sources. Legally. Legally, I should tell you.
Doesn't matter
there
to me.
There we go. Okay. So, yeah, so we can have a cut of music. And I apologize, Rick, but I am going to be leaving the room for a couple of minutes as you read. And I have to open the door now because your audience has arrived. And, you know, you can't do a reading without your audience.
Hey, how are you?
And I know that Lester loves listening to you read. I know that for a fact.
You're a masochist.
Glad to see you.
Glad to see you. And I like your headgear there.
So you can read and Lester can.
Oh, I thought you were leaving the room.
I am. I will be. Yes.
Okay, this is a story that appeared in Electric Velociped, and that introduction that I read earlier, that thing about Electric Velociped, is the introduction to this story. I wrote this with Mark Rich, and as I say in the introduction, Mark Rich is a poet, and the kid in the story is a poet. And the beauty of this was, I can't write poetry, but every time we needed a poem for the story, Mark would turn one out. And eventually, I liked this so much that I made him turn them out, even though I wasn't using them for the story, just so I could read them. But the story is called Jacket Jackson by Richard Bowes and Mark Rich, and it begins with a short poem. I close my eyes and draw in blue distances of smoky air, the ceiling strands of a city of no time, city of cast-off futures. It's written by Jacket Jackson. In a year of promises deep in the heart of the 20th century, Chris Brown hit the road. He was 19. His draft board had lost touch with him. His mother and stepfather were just divorced, and he had flunked out of college back east. Driving a blue, beat-up 1954 Dodge Royale ragtop, Chris was as free as any American. The man at the last gas stop on 66 had a boozed-up grin and see-nothing eyes. No one sees anything, Chris thought. I walk in a dead land with an invisible city carried in the air over my head, and no one ever sees. Chris wrote poetry. The tank topped out at $2.35 worth of gas. As he pulled away with 67 cents in change, he caught a flash of silver, something barreling down an ebony causeway. In the Marseille, city of lost history, a bike and rider swept along an otherwise deserted esplanade of the Silk Serpents. The hands and head of the biker were shiny aluminum. Blue liquid dribbled from its mouth. It wore jeans and boots, a leather jacket unzipped, flapped in the wind. "Ah, but this is bracing to observe," said the clockmaster to Tompkin of the Tompkins, his flux agent. They stood in Moxay, city of a dozen suns, looking down from the terrace of the Pitch of Dreams. "Desperate fun!" His voice rang like chimes. "Jackson's remarkable jacket has a new friend, all metal, and on a motorcycle." One sun rose while another set. Orange light bounced off the aluminum torso as the bike roared across Tangletongue Bridge, past the graveyard of unbearable children and the centuries-wide patio of platitudes. The biker hung a left at the tobacco gardens. "Remember the summer of the raggle-taggle girl?" the flux agent said, lips pursed in amusement. "We had ground Seth Jackson to dust, all but destroyed the memory of his existence. Yet he returned, a bit of him anyway. That girl, she dashed in here, wearing Jackson's jacket, and left us with those gardens. Then I found her near the hissing stairs," said the clockmaster, "creating something that involved an absinthe fountain and a carousel. The tinkle of the music was at the edge of my ear when I drilled the raggle-taggle girl full of the darts of time." "Always deadly, that arm of yours," said Tompkin of the Tompkins. "Yet the jacket crawled off her back and got away to some obscure solips in the outer possibilities, only to return with this chrome mannequin." As the motorcycle roared past the tobacco gardens, the cigar trees all glowed at their tips and puffed clouds of welcome. The flux agent heard the clockmaster tick a bit faster at that, saw his lips twitch. On a terrace elsewhere in Maxey, city of dreaming spires, a small rubber ball bounced on the marble floor once, twice, and went over the edge. Far below them, Jackson's jacket said, "Hard right, go for the barrows." Metal hands steered the bike toward a long marble ramp. On a terrace 5 levels down, red flashed on the couch where Pauline of the fiery red hair stretched and turned in her mechanical boredom. When the cycle hit the ramp, thousands of tiny metal jacks, the kind kids grab at between ball bounces when scattering across the road. Piles of them broke and sprayed like gravel beneath the tires. They clicked and clattered, catching in the spikes. They rattled against the engine. The motorcycle coughed and skidded. It smashed through a railing. As it fell, the aluminum driver raised his hands from the handles. The jacket slipped off its arms and billowed open in the air. All akimbo, it floated within sight of the balcony, where Pauline now stood at the railing, her eyes bright, her hair twining around her shoulders. She reached for the jacket. Like a bullet, the rubber ball ricocheted off a wall. It smacked into the jacket and drove it spinning away from Pauline's outstretched arms. The jacket fell, turning over and over, growing smaller as it fell out of Maxey, city of the pink smoke clouds. Seth Jackson was dead. The jacket knew this. The clockmaster, Prince of Stasis, had pressed him into the dust that was ground ever finer by Maxey's turning and writhing foundations. Still, the aroma of those tobacco trees. It remembered the factory workroom somewhere in a backwash town near the west end of humankind, where the liquid fire first flowed from Jackson's veins into the jacket-shaped webwork of carbon and steel, circuitry and leather. Life coursed into its fabric. It rippled at its edges just outside time. Jackson had draped the jacket over a stool, then leaned back against the table, lighting a cigar. He stared at his creation. The jacket would stay shining and dark despite the dulling of months. Its fabric would ripple and turn after the hammering of years. Its shape would hold without tattering against the gales of the centuries it swept through. Carbon and steel circuitry and leather and love. And Jackson disliked a certain Prince of Stasis. As the jacket fell, it called out to the dust of its creator. "Where now?" it said. "Find him," it said. "There," said the jacket, seeking a sun-baked, hardened place. And I think I'll stop there. And that is from the story Jacket Jackson, which is in If Angels Fight, which is a collection that I brought out last year.
Published by? Is that P.S.?
No, God knows. It's Fairwood. Fairwood Press.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
It's Fairwood Press. And this also...
In the Northwest.
in the out in out in,
out in the northwest,
out in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Yes,
nice people.
As
I met, I'm forgetting his name. I met him at ReaderCon.
Absolutely, and yes, very nice people to work for. And what can I say? Yes, you can buy that too on Amazon.com and or any other online source. But yes, Greenwood Press, and
people can they may not buy the books at your website. They should visit your blog nonetheless.
They should. RickBowes.com. Everyone should visit that.
Absolutely.
And if you're on Facebook, you should come and communicate with me on Facebook.
Yeah. There you go. You got birthday wishes yesterday.
I got such birthday wishes, yes.
Mine was last week. I went 3 score last week.
I did much better than you. I'm 70 at this point.
Are you? So we both had landmark birthdays.
Had landmark
within
birthdays,
a week of
yes.
each other.
They say the first 70 years are the hardest, and the next 70 years are much easier.
Oh, good.
Yes, I've been told that, yes.
Yeah.
Why, thank
so you're
you.
All...
And how old are you?
62.
My God, you're in incredible shape. My goodness gracious. When I was 62, I was already a complete wreck.
It's the Rasta thing, you know. It's
the hat.
Oh, is that what
it's the hat. I know it is. No, I had no idea. I assumed you were a kid.
Well, he is.
Well, emotionally, and yes, we're all children. I mean,
yeah. But, I don't judge a person by chronological. That's just, you know.
No.
No longer relevant to me now that I've turned 60.
Now that when, yeah, once you get old, you don't want anyone to judge people by age because, you know.
When I started many, many years ago when I was starting the show on a solo basis, somebody would call up and say, well, you remember in Captain Video where such and such? And I said, no, I'm sorry. I never saw Captain Video. It's like, you haven't?
And,
it's
like, and yet you call yourself a person?
I was 20 because I've been doing this show a very long time. And the person said, you're 20, and hung up on me.
Right. Well, it's as he should have, because that is a disgusting thing. But
It really is. Yeah. It really is.
But it's...
By the way...
It's something that time will cure.
I guess so. I guess so. It is also, by the way, an anniversary for Hour of the Wolf. I don't know the exact date. We do know, in fact, that it's close to an anniversary for WBAI, because WBAI joined Pacifica on January 10th, 1960. So that's known. And I think it's somewhere about the 15th or the 20th that Margot Adler began Hour of the Wolf in 1972.
72.
Oh. It was 1972 that this show began. Where Margot did the show 5 days a week until she went to the 1974, I believe, Clarion Workshop. And that's when I took the show over. And when she came back from Clarion...
Transformed.
She took another time slot. So, you know. It's, and I was there until 3 years ago when I got bumped.
Yes. Was it only 3 years ago?
It was three years ago last October, yeah.
And I was on the first show you did at this time.
I made a big point of that, yes, exactly. And that's when you first met Lister.
Right.
So actually when we both first met Lister. So yeah, that was about 3 years, 3 months ago.
Seems like yesterday. This is one of the things about being 70 years old. Everything seems like yesterday.
I imagine so, yes. So let's see. There we go. I'm tagging you.
You're tagging me, huh?
Yeah, I'm...
Like an endangered species, you know.
It's if anybody's on Instagram or Facebook... You can now... You can now see a fuzzy picture of Rick.
A fuzzy picture, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, the clarity isn't great. It's not as good as... actually, one of your online avatars that you use are is a picture of you at 120 Wall Street at our past studios.
Well, and it's the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I think, is what is going on there, isn't it? No, I guess not. I don't know.
Well, you know, actually, I believe it is, because that was not in the master.
No, is that the one where I have the headphones on?
Yeah.
That was here.
That was here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, good God.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That was here.
Well, now you've got another. But
I have some
better.
Yeah, those. Are there any calls?
There are, as a matter of fact.
There's some people have nothing better to do at that time. It's a horrible thing to...
And it went away, just as you asked.
Really?
Just as you asked.
Did they?
But we'll tell... But we all know who that caller is, right? But if anybody else wants to call up, it's 212-209-2900.
Boy, that's going to be your dying words, will be.
Well, no, I'll probably get the number wrong because there were so many phone numbers that were burned into my brain. There was Oxford 7, da-da-da-da. I can't say it anymore because other people have these numbers now. And I have always been so tempted to, like, call all the major old WBAI numbers and find out who's there now and how much trouble they've gotten into over the years
It is extremely... I knew somebody who had... What was it called? It was a bagel. It was the... Something bagel company here in Greenwich Village. The Karma, it wasn't the Karmic Bagel Company, but it was something like that.
I know that there was one.
You're right, but there was something like that, and they had gone out of business. Their karma was such that they couldn't endure. And this person
had a hole in
right,
it. Yeah.
This person had the number, and people were constantly calling. She said, you wouldn't believe how many people, drunk out of their minds, decided they wanted bagels at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know?
Yeah. But I would, you know...
The Cosmic Bagel Company.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And when I would get into a zone where I would be pitching, and I have all these phone numbers... we were pitching them 10, 15 years. It's not like I'm just slipping a tiny bit. I'm still introducing this show every morning as, you know, a Saturday morning program. Then I wake up and go, wait, no, it's Wednesday night.
That's right. Indeed.
Wait
till you get to be 70. You're really going to be a trip.
Yeah, I'm already there. 212-209-2900. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Mean, James, we have nothing better to do. As if the choice is...
I didn't say that.
No, I said that.
Well, Rick, happy birthday anyway. And since James' birthday, didn't realize...
And happy birthday to you, too. When it's my birthday, it's everyone's birthday.
Mine was 3 months ago. And
you're going to have another one.
Well, yeah, there you go.
When I hit 70, I won't tell you what it was like, but that's another story. So you had 30 brave souls last night. I would have been 31, I do promise you, except... But as you probably noticed, Mama Natura played much havoc with the airlines yesterday, including my flight, which did not get in for 8 hours.
Yes, well, my partner was supposed to be in Las Vegas, damn it, and she booked
that.
The only airline that actually canceled flights instead of postponed.
So she missed her flight to good old Vegas?
Yep. She was at the reading last night, whereas in fact she should have been coming home late tonight.
Well,
we were all happy to see her.
Brave souls.
Her job is to be at CES.
I'll be honest with you, just as you hate pornography, I hate extreme cold. I really do. It terrifies me for a lot of reasons, including ice, but that's another story. I wanted to mention something to Rick. A couple of things. Boy, are you bringing back memories of the 60s. I know some Weisenheimer once said, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. Some of us do.
That's Carlin. You know, it's not attributable to some Weisenheimer.
Well,
that's George Carlin. Give the man his due.
But I do remember the Wah and the Gaslight and the Ogogo and those Monday nights at Gertie's.
Gertie's Folk City.
I loved Gertie's.
For your 10 minutes of fame, you sold
I went to go see Carolyn Hester.
Oh, Carolyn Hester.
Wow. There's a name that not everybody remembers.
No, it's a name that I...
Bonnie Dobson.
Well, you...
Jesus.
No, yeah, I remember her.
Carolyn Hester came out of Texas.
But Carolyn Hester, I had a good friend. He was slightly, somewhat older than I, not slightly older than I. And I would go with him, and he had a thing for Carolyn Hester, and... we would go there and sometimes be like, you know, one of three tables at Gertie's at the opening thing there. And Carolyn would come over and sit down with us. And
well, one of the things about that scene is how many women and quite popular performers there were and how few of their names have come down to us. You know, you have, of course, you have Dylan. I mean, you have Byers, but... a lot of the guys' names survive, but very few of the female performers.
Carolyn Hester was one. Bonnie Dobson out of Toronto was another.
Yep.
Right.
I mean, they were just wonderful.
There were Peter and Wendy. They
yes,
were.
Yes.
Remember Peter and Wendy with the auto harp?
Yeah.
Was it the Back Fence? Was that their place?
Yes.
And they were around...
They played there
the
for
back
like
fence,
20 years.
Right, the Back Fence was still churning the stuff out until about
you
10 or 12
gal,
years ago.
Yeah.
You remember a gal singer named Joan Tolliver? Had a voice like a
I
bass.
Actually do.
Somebody once said about her that if, never mind, she had this wonderful song about woman, being a woman, and what women did. And stuff like that. I just wanted to bring up one thing, Rick, about your Queen, Camber, and seven others. It got honorable mention at the most recent American Folklore Society gathering, and I'll tell you why. There was a panel called New Wine from Old Bottles, or it was called Roots and Branches.
That's actually a good title.
And somebody mentioned...
Hello?
Somebody that we all know mentioned in a panel your book... and compared you, and it's interesting that you mentioned Theodora Goss, because I absolutely agree that those two collections are companion volumes. And somebody mentioned that your fairy tales in that book reminded one of Theodora Goss, Angela Carter, and Jane Yolen.
It's good company.
That is fine company. And who was that person?
Me.
Yes, I had thought it was.
But it's a great collection, especially your story on Merlin and Queen Victoria.
Well, the thing about that Merlin and Queen Victoria story was that it was done for a themed anthology, and it was rejected by the themed anthology, but it has been printed
that
and reprinted everywhere.
That wasn't, by the way, the Datlow Queen Victoria's Book of Spells, was it?
You are really a very astute follower of this.
Yes.
It was, but it's been...
It's a beautiful story.
I like the story. I wrote the story. But it's been recorded. I mean, there's a podcast of it from Podcastle. It's appearing in a couple of anthologies. It, you know, was printed in Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
Which is a hard sale.
Not for me, but...
no, not for you.
Not for me.
And you got on the cover there, too.
I just want to ask you, Rick, one question about the story specifically. The concept of Merlin growing younger as the future went on, was that yours, or was that a traditional...
That's traditional.
No, that actually, I believe, was introduced in the Once and Future King.
Yeah, it's T.H. White, so it's not traditional, but it's modern traditional.
No, but I mean, it's not Rick Bowes.
No, it isn't.
I thought it was, actually.
It's T.H. White.
It's T.H. White. It's been used by others, not to that purpose, but...
Zelazny used it.
Well, there is in the original, the Welsh, because, I mean, all of this is from the Welsh. In the original Welsh legend, there is a space-time diffusion for Merlin. I think that White took this and, you know, civilized it, basically.
By the way, I have to say, the other story that I really loved was your take on Johnny Cake, or what did you call it, the Gingerbread Boy. I love that little thing.
The Cinnamon Cavalier.
I loved it.
Why, thank you. Thank you.
James,
I love doing it.
Anyway, James, I know that you're coming up against it. By the way, James.
Yeah, we've got 2.5 minutes.
How did your music spectacular go last Wednesday night?
Well, it wasn't a music spectacular.
Oh, okay. Well, Oh, well, hopefully you did play some good music.
We didn't know. We didn't play any music whatsoever.
Music at all. Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
No, I had two critics, Terrence Taylor, well, he's a critic of everything, of life, and Dan Persons, and we were talking mostly about her.
Okay.
And criticizing her.
Well, they were criticizing her. I was praising her. I was praising her more than everybody liked it. This
her,
is important.
Her being the movie?
But her, yeah, her happens to be a movie.
Yeah, then I know.
And the Dan, you know, if one had to give it a score, would probably give it like a 78. Terrence would give it about an 84, an 85, and I would give it a 95. And we had a fascinating discussion about the different things that we took out of the movie. And one of the best things that can be said for the movie is that you can have that discussion.
Right. It certainly is an unusual film.
I see.
Yeah, it's you don't have to love it. But it. You
oh, I
will...
thought you did. I thought there was a
no,
penalty.
No, it's only me.
For
that's only me.
Oh,
no. But I think you do have to watch it, and I think that you have to take out of it what you will.
So it is worth going to see. You would say
it is.
Your opinion.
Taking gravity out of the equation, although gravity is science fiction. Outside of gravity, her is the best science fiction film of 2013. But Gravity is really the best science fiction film of 2013.
And I do not have
but they're in different, totally different worlds.
And I certainly
worlds.
Do not have to ask your opinion of Desolation.
If I could sit through it, we sat through it and we got nothing from it. It was just too much of an onslaught of media, wow. And by the time that Small comes on the scene, you can't watch it.
What was your opinion, I know this is small, of the love interest? Or did that even...
anything that brings a femininity into Tolkien is probably for the better. But to have her fall in love with a dwarf is just... stupid beyond belief.
Yeah, that's what a friend of mine said. Anyway, Happy New Year, happy birthday.
You've offended the dwarfs.
The weather will be better. Who are the readers for February? Do we know yet?
We do. They are Nancy Hightower, who will also be here on the program in 2 weeks, and Dr. D.T. Friedman.
Neither of whom I'm familiar with, but that's the best.
Well, one has been on the show, and one will be on the show, and both are
very lovely young ladies.
Two very lovely young ladies, indeed.
And that will be February?
The first Tuesday. Yes.
See you then.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Be there or be square.
I tend to be square. Okay, now, you see, now I haven't found...
But you're always there.
No. I mean, actually, there have been readings where I have called upon others.
I never noticed.
To fill in for me. Yeah, actually, Bill Shun once took over.
Oh, that's right. I had forgotten that.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure you were actually there.
I believe I was there in corporeal form, yes.
Yeah, very much so. So next week on this program is not a certainty, but I believe I am going to be celebrating another birthday, which I think would have been the 7th, Tuesday, Alfie Bester.
Oh.
His birthday was, I believe, the 7th, and we're going to celebrate that next week. He will be 100.
Would have been, yes.
Well, he was born 100. That's, you know what they say now? It's the 100th anniversary of his birth.
Yes.
You know, that's the way they put it, and that's fine. So we will probably, I am going to desperately see if I can find him reading The Men Who Murdered Mohammed, which he read on this program.
It's a good story.
It's a good story, and it was a wonderful reading. And I will certainly be telling Alfie Bester's stories of personal, which are You should see Rick's face; he's blanching. They are the stories are myriad, and
I hope no children are listening. It will frighten them away from a career in writing. Certainly
they are generally not family friendly, these stories. Very, very funny, though. Very good ones.
Oh, it was...
And most involve liquor. But anyway, and maybe we'll play an episode of The Shadow that he wrote. He was the script editor of The Shadow for a number of years.
He was everything at one time, right?
Oh, yeah, Holiday Magazine, I believe. Yeah. He was a columnist there.
FNSF. Did he have something to do with them?
I think he had a column.
Yeah, he had a column.
I think he had a column in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. Richard Bowes has Dust Devil on a... Quiet Street. I'm never quiet, so I never notice.
Which was the title of an old Naked City episode.
That's
right.
I liked
the title so well, I took it.
Yeah, you appropriated it. The other books in print, The Queen,
The Cambion, and Seven Others, is a collection of modern fairy tales. I can't remember. If Angels Fight is a collection of stories over my entire short story writing career.
And Minions of the Moon.
Minions of the Moon is in reprint. And
with a new material.
New story, yes, that completely contradicts the storyline of the original novel. But that's my privilege as a writer.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Rick.
Well,
everybody should also visit rickbowes.com and visit us both on Facebook.
Yes, visit me on Facebook. I'm at my best. It's all pictures.
And you can look up, they're fun too, and look up Hour of the Wolf on Facebook.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way.
A young man.
Over these same airwaves. Stay tuned and have a wonderful morning. Stay warm.
Wake up to the lies, the pigs, makeup, imperialistic swines that I grind. talk funny, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascist and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the message must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Sing the list alive right here. 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. 6 minutes after 3 o'clock right here. Flag burning time. 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. We're gonna do this until 5 o'clock right here. 99 Sinker list alive. This is why we had to call the show Burn Baby Burn, because we play all the music they refuse to play on radio right here at 99 Sinker list alive on a Thursday. Yeah, you know, you heard it here first. My Jamaican breakfast, not to be mixed up with my Manhattan breakfast. Irie. 212-209-2900. You have a birthday. Let's celebrate it together. 99 Cinco, list alive.
She's a face in the crowd, looking right through ya, as if she knew ya better than you know yourself. What does she know about
hard and stiff, could I never mix, yeah?
When you start looking around, yeah, you know there's no pretending. Cause how you twist and bend it, she's the perfect girl. Leave everyone spellbound when she mixes and blends it. Cause the message she's sending, she's ready to sell out.
Cool day.